Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, October 14th, 2020. This is Section A. The headline reads, Board Takes on Renaming of Lee High School, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland ISD Board will decide on the new name for Robert E. Lee High School during a special meeting to be held at 5:30 p.m. today at Bowie Fine Arts Academy Auditorium, 805 Elk Avenue. The meeting and expected decision will mark the end of an 11-week process that started on July 27th when the board, by a 6-1 decision, voted to rename the school. The board then selected a citizens' renaming committee, which after multiple meetings decided on three names to bring to the board. Those names are Legacy of Equality and Excellence High School, Tall City High School, and Carver Lee High School. Legacy of Equality and Excellence High School received the most votes and is considered the committee's number one selection. The district provided information to the Reporter-Telegram last week that showed a name change could cost as much as $3.469 million. Board President Rick Davis stated in an opinion article this past weekend that any, quote, cost may be offset by any money that may be raised by those who have volunteered to do so, period. He also said the timing of a bond designed to address secondary facility needs would be one reason not to implement all changes immediately. If, for example, a bond next November proposes to relocate Lee High School to a new campus and repurpose the existing campus, all the campus ramifications of this name change can be included on the new LHS campus at no additional cost, he wrote. Who's for it? Who's not? It is expected that the school board will first vote on Legacy of Equality and Excellence High School. If there are four votes for Legacy of Equality and Excellence, then that will replace Robert E. Lee as the names at the senior and freshman high schools. If there are not four votes, another nomination may come from the board. It appears that when it comes to Legacy of Equality and Excellence High School, there are already two no votes. James Fuller stated during District 1 forums that he will not support any school name with Lee or the Lee acronym in it. Davis, in his article this past week, expressed his support for a different option, Legacy High School. He said this for LHS, the rebel mascot, and the maroon and white colors would be retained. About the meeting, Midland ISD said that people who want to speak during the public comment portion of the meeting should sign up from 4:30 to 5:20 p.m. The district also announced that it will follow health and safety guidelines at the meeting. Seating arrangements will be spaced to promote safe distancing, and masks will be required for all on-site attendees, MISD wrote on the agenda notice. The district will also have masks and hand sanitizer available to all members of the public who wish to attend. Seating will be limited in the main auditorium based on the safe distancing guidelines the district must follow. Seating will be available on a first-come, first-served basis. The district will prepare an additional viewing room at the location for members of the public who did not get a seat in the main auditorium. Those interested can also watch the meeting via its live stream link. This article is entitled, MISD, Davis, Applicants Will Know Board Expects Goals to Be Met. Board President said Riddick's departure will not hurt district in finding replacement, by Stuart Doreen. Will Orlando Riddick's departure from Midland ISD have an impact on the search for the next superintendent? Midland ISD Board President Rick Davis responded to the idea that the change will negatively impact the district in looking for the right person to take over. Davis, after Monday's special board meeting, said, I believe that they'll know we mean what we say when we set goals, and we expect this next superintendent to achieve those goals, and that they'll know if there's any doubt in their mind about that before, there should be no doubt now. Riddick's departure after three years was because of accountability, Davis has said. In August, he wrote in an op-ed explaining the decision to part ways with the former superintendent that Riddick did not meet expectations set by the board. Riddick was the district's third permanent superintendent since Sylvester Perez took over in 2006. If you're not interested in moving this district forward and achieving some real goals and making real progress, then you need not apply, Davis said. But we are confident that we're going to have some really good candidates that are interested and that believe that there's a real opportunity here to make academic progress with the support of the community or nonprofits, foundations, and the teaching staff that we have. Davis said Superintendent Ann Dixon will play a role in the superintendent search. She said after the meeting Monday that she will talk with local leaders and groups about what they want in the next superintendent. The board on Monday also agreed to have Walsh and Gallegos help with the superintendent search. Dixon was the interim superintendent at Red Oak ISD, located outside the Metroplex, when board members there hired Walsh Gallegos as its superintendent search firm. In March 2019, Santa Gertrude ISD, located outside Kingsville, hired Walsh Gallegos and Dixon to conduct its search. Walsh Gallegos has offices in Austin, San Antonio, Irving, the Rio Grande Valley, Houston, Amarillo, and Albuquerque, New Mexico, according to its website. Davis expected that the firm's estimate fee range was between $16,000 and $20,000, which he said was less than what the district paid Hazard Young, Attia & Associates, the search firm that found Riddick. Davis said after the meeting that the district will post the position for applications. Once the new board is seated, the applications will be reviewed and applicants will be selected for interviews. My personal goal for the next superintendent is to find a way to support principals and teachers in the classroom and to bring an attitude that central office works for them, Davis said. They don't work for central office. This article is entitled, Local Bar Owners Don't Expect Changes. Abbott is allowing the businesses to open at 50% capacity, by J.C. Lewis. Midland bar owners haven't changed operations after Governor Greg Abbott's announcement last week that bars could open at 50% capacity. The general manager of Tall City Brewing Company, Jeff Thomas, said the business currently is benefiting by operating as a restaurant at 75% capacity. We didn't have much of a reaction. For one, we didn't even know he was speaking, Thomas said. We saw a tweet from a few weeks ago of him saying that there was a possibility of him reopening bars. Thomas said he assumed Abbott was going to make an announcement, but nothing has been clear. He added that he was happy the governor announced bars could reopen. The food and beverage permit that Tall City Brewing Company applied for will continue to allow them to operate at 75% capacity instead of 50% capacity under the brewpub license. It makes sense to keep our food and beverage permit and be under the classification of a restaurant to stay open at 75%, he said. Thomas said they might go back to the original permit when bars are able to increase their capacity. However, they would still have food trucks on site while the brewery operates, he said. Owner of the Blue Door, Erica Mann, said the announcement was a repeat of the same approach the governor has had since the beginning. Earlier this summer, he put the onus on TABC, she said. He said bars are the only businesses that can't open, and it's TABC's job to make sure that they're compliant. And that's not really TABC's job. She said Abbott isn't committing to reopening by saying businesses can open in the county if judges allow it. Midland County Judge Terry Johnson did not return phone calls seeking comment. Abbott's attitude has created a lot of frustration for bar owners, he said. I feel like he is playing with people's livelihoods by not owning a position, Mann said. He is playing with their mental health. To be quite honest, because he put that really odd tweet out a few days before he made that announcement that was once again giving bar owners and their employees a lot of hope that he was going to reopen bars. But then there was that catch. Mann said she is not impressed with the governor's actions. The Blue Door will continue operating at 50% capacity because of the 6-foot spacing rule for tables that doesn't allow for 75% capacity. This article is entitled City. Midland man dies after being ejected from vehicle, from staff reports. A 40-year-old Midland man died early Tuesday morning in a one-vehicle crash on Loop 250, according to a press release from the city's spokeswoman. Pedro Lugo was driving a Range Rover eastbound in the 4400 block of West Loop 250. The vehicle left the roadway and entered the center median, causing the driver to lose control and the SUV to roll several times, according to the release. Lugo, who was not wearing a seatbelt, was ejected from the vehicle, according to the release. He died at the scene. Alcohol is believed to be a contributing factor in the crash. The investigation is ongoing. Police and fire departments were dispatched to the crash site at about 2:30 a.m. Tuesday. Lugo is the 18th person to die in crashes on roads in Midland County this year, according to Reporter Telegram records. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled City Reports 43 New Cases of Coronavirus in Midland from Staff Reports. The city on Tuesday reported 43 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Midland County, bringing the total number during the pandemic to 4,287. These new cases are reflected of lab results from Monday, according to a press release from the city's spokeswoman. The health department also reported there are 1,397 active cases and 2,572 people have recovered. There have been 86 COVID-19 related deaths in Midland County. This article is entitled MISD Reports 33 New Virus Cases from September 30th to October 9th by Stuart Doreen. Like much of the rest of Midland County, the number of coronavirus cases inside Midland ISD is going up. The school district reported there were 33 new confirmed cases between September 30th and October 9th. The MISD website report also shows the number of cases is up to 147 people, employees or students, since June 22nd. That includes 32 cases through October 9th. That followed 63 in September. The district reported that its tracking of coronavirus cases by campus also would include students who tested positive. The district in the past few weeks has started to bring students back on campus as part of its phase-in program for re-entry. Midland ISD has said that each notification triggers a series of steps, which includes sanitizing and disinfecting, notification of individuals in close proximity, and notification to the health department. Anytime we become aware of an individual with a confirmed case who was present at a public gathering, such as a board meeting or sporting event, we will also issue a press release. The district also reported there weren't any closures needed in September, and so far, none in October. This is the election page. This article is entitled, Congressional Candidates Offer Opposing Ideas on Corona's Oil Market, by Caitlin Randall. In contrast to the recent presidential and vice presidential debates, candidates for Texas's 11th Congressional District remained cordial Monday night as they presented opposing ideas for tackling issues like COVID-19, border security, and the oil market turndown. The three candidates were asked during a debate hosted by Basin PBS what measures they would support to reduce the number of coronavirus deaths in the U.S. and as the number of deaths climbs over 215,000. All said they were opposed to a national lockdown, and Republican August Pfluger and Libertarian Wasey Alpha Cody said they opposed any national intervention. Democrat John Mark Hogg, however, was critical of how President Trump's administration has handled the pandemic and advocated for a national strategy that includes expanded access to testing and contact tracing, more funding for personal protective equipment, and paid time off for those who contract the virus and need to quarantine. When asked how they would help West Texas reemerge as an oil powerhouse following the economic downturn, Pfluger said it was important for the U.S. to have a level playing field against countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia, while Hogg said he supported a national policy to maintain oil prices. Cody indicated he thought the government should be hands-off in matters related to the oil market. The candidates also offered competing ideas when asked their views on immigration reform. Before we can get to the point where we reform immigration, we have to make sure the country is secure, Pfluger said. We need to make sure when we're protecting our country that we do that foremost and we do it right. Hogg disagreed, saying you cannot secure the border unless you fix the immigration issue first. He also said he was in favor of using technology to step up border control rather than the wall that has been a cornerstone of Trump's campaign and presidency. The candidates disagreed on funding for the arts and public schools as well, with Cody and Pfluger saying they did not believe that federal funding should go toward arts in education. Pfluger criticized the $25 million for the Kennedy Center that was included in the CARES Act. By contrast, Hogg said the arts are crucial to education, and there should be more opportunity for schools to apply for funding through the National Endowment of the Arts. For all they disagreed on, though, the men's views also aligned on a number of topics. The three candidates said they did not believe in abolishing the Electoral College, and Pfluger and Hogg agreed that China is one of the biggest threats to national interests. All candidates also committed to not supporting a ban on fracturing were they to be elected. Hogg said fracturing is essential to the U.S. and global economy, and noted the development of renewable resources is not possible without fracturing. Pfluger said, it's absolutely critical that fracturing continues to provide inexpensive energy. And Cody said the government should not have the power to regulate fracturing. Monday's event was the final congressional debate for District 11. Early voting began Tuesday in Texas and will continue through October 30th. Election Day is November 3rd. This article is entitled, Despite Virus Fears, Texas Sends Most Voters to Polls, by Acacio Coronado, Report for America, Associated Press. Houston. Early voting began Tuesday with long lines in Texas, one of the few places in the U.S. not allowing widespread mail balloting during the pandemic. And Jill Biden rallied supporters across the red state that Democrats are no longer writing off. Texas is just one of five states that did not dramatically expand mail-in voting this year because of COVID-19. And hours before the polls open, Republican Governor Greg Abbott's order limiting counties to one mail ballot drop box was upheld by a federal appeals court, stopping dozens of shuttered sites around Texas from reopening. Both the virus and Texas's high stakes in November were front of mind in Jill Biden's first stop, the border city of El Paso, where Abbott has deployed more nurses and medical equipment as cases and hospitalizations climb. Campaigning for her husband, former Vice President Joe Biden, she was due to end her 800-mile swing across Texas in Houston, with a stop in Dallas in between. Regina Kuchipin, a registered Democrat and Houston resident, said she still didn't feel safe eating in restaurants because of the coronavirus, but that she was willing to be among crowds to exercise her right to vote. I think that now that people know how to take how serious it is and what precautions to take, I think those who are ready to come out are taking those precautions, said Kuchipin, a healthcare worker. By Tuesday afternoon, Houston election officials reported more than 100,000 votes had been cast in Harris County, a record turnout for a single day of early voting, which continues through October 30th. Long lines were common at polling sites across Texas, as were masks, although voters are not required to wear them inside polling places. In suburban Houston's Fort Bend County, technical problems kept machines offline for more than an hour as hundreds of people waited to vote. The county's top elected official said he would authorize an investigation. Those who are responsible will be held accountable, said Fort Bend County Judge K.P. George. Much is on the line in America's largest red state, which has competitive congressional and state legislative races and is a potential presidential background. And local election authorities have been pulling out all the stops to ensure the state's 16 million registered voters can safely cast their ballots in person. In Harris County, which includes Houston and is home to more than 2.5 million voters, there will be triple the number of polling places compared to previous elections. Voters will be able to choose between standing in socially distant lines to vote in person at a polling place, or a drive-through option that resembles pulling up to order at a fast food restaurant. Some polling places will stay open later than usual on select nights. And on October 29th, 7 locations will be open for 24 hours. Court reinstates Texas limit on ballot drop-off locations. Austin. A federal appeals court has reinstated a limit on the number of mail-in ballot drop-off locations in Texas, although Governor Greg Abbott and a federal judge came under criticism for trying to sidestep the legislature to alter state election law. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, late Monday, issued a stay of a federal judge's ruling on Friday that the Republican governor's order is a likely violation of a voter's right to vote. Early voting started Tuesday in Texas. Leaving the governor's October 1st proclamation in place still gives Texas absentee voters many ways to cast their ballots in the November 3rd election, Judge Stuart Kyle Duncan wrote in the opinion. These methods for remote voting outstrip what Texas law previously permitted in a pre-COVID world. The October 1st proclamation abridges no one's right to vote. Abbott's order limits mail-in drop-off locations to one per county, shuttering dozens of sites in some of Texas's largest cities, mostly Democratic strongholds. The appeals court, however, noted that the order also provides Texas voters with 40 additional days to vote absentee, and that they have many ways to deliver their absentee ballots before November 3rd, including by hand and by mail. These methods for remote voting outstrip what Texas law previously permitted in a pre-COVID world. The October 1st proclamation abridges no one's right to vote, Duncan wrote. Abbott said the limit on drop-off sites is needed to ensure election security, while Democrats and voting rights groups, including the League of United Latin American Citizens, called it an effort to suppress voters. The lawsuit challenging Abbott's order was filed by the Texas League of United Latin American Citizens, the National League of United Latin American Citizens, and the League of Women Voters in Texas, and two voters. In a concurring opinion, Judge James Ho wrote that he grudgingly agrees with Duncan, but that the federal judge and Abbott were both wrong in trying to change state election laws. The district court was wrong to rewrite Texas law, but the distinguished judge who did so was simply following in the governor's footsteps. It is surely just as offensive to the Constitution to rewrite Texas election law by execution fiat as it is to do so by judicial fiat, he wrote. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, Coney Barrett Hasn't Been Nominated for Healthcare Czar, by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Amy Coney Barrett has accomplished many things in her career. Becoming an authority or a policymaker on healthcare isn't one of them. At Notre Dame, she was a professor at the law school, not at the Eck Institute for Global Health. She's written for the Cornell Law Review, not the New England Journal of Medicine. She's up to replace the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court, not Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. No one would have guessed it, though, from listening to Democratic senators on the first day of her much-anticipated confirmation hearings. They acted as if Barrett has been nominated to become the nation's health care czar, responsible for everything from the fate of Obamacare to the country's coronavirus response. It sounded less like a Judiciary Committee hearing and more like a meeting of the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. This tack underlined political themes that Democrats are hammering home in the final weeks of the election. But they have little or nothing to do with Amy Coney Barrett, a judge seeking to sit on the highest court in the land. The proximate cause of the Democratic assault on health care is the imminent arrival of an anti-Obamacare lawsuit in the Supreme Court. The Democratic theory is that Barrett is being sent on a not-so-secret mission to destroy the health care law. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois says this is her assignment. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island says that she is a judicial torpedo aimed at the Affordable Care Act. The lawsuit emanates from a prior Supreme Court ruling on Obamacare to keep the law from being struck down over its individual mandate. Chief Justice John Roberts reinterpreted the penalty for not complying with the mandate as a tax. Subsequently, Congress zeroed out the tax. Now, Texas and other states are contending that this tax that no one pays cannot be truly considered a tax and must be struck down, as well as the rest of the law. It's hard to see how the suit succeeds. One hurdle is standing. The plaintiffs need to demonstrate a harm, which isn't easy when the offending provision is a tax or a penalty of zero. Even if the court throws out the penalty, it would have to conclude that this unenforced provision is so central to the ACA that the rest of the law has to go too. That would be a stretch. If Barrett is really on a mission to strike down all of the ACA, she could show up and find herself the lone vote to do so. But there's no reason to believe she is on such an assignment. Barrett was one of a number of judges participating in a moot court at William & Mary Law School in September that considered the ACA suit. The votes were anonymous, but not one judge favored throwing out the health care law. If the Democratic case against Barrett isn't landing any blows, it is telling nonetheless. As always, progressives don't view the Supreme Court as a neutral body devoted to interpreting the Constitution and the law as written, but as a super legislature that should protect and advance their policy goals. As far as they are concerned, there's no reason a Supreme Court hearing should be different from any other forum for the advocacy of policy. Barrett has a more modest and appropriate view of the court's role. After getting lectures for hours about the benefits of the ACL, she rightly said in her opening statement, "The policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches elected by and accountable to the people. The public should not expect courts to do so, and courts should not try." In short, if she wanted to create health care policy, she would have gotten into a different line of work. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, "Board Turnover Shouldn't Be Result of Renaming Decision," by Stuart Doreen, editor. The Midland ISD board tonight will make what is easily one of the most high-profile decisions that I can remember, and it is one of the most inconsequential when it comes to academic performance. It has been interesting to read the social media comments when it comes to the renaming of Robert E. Lee High School. Often, those in support of keeping the Lee name ridicule board members because changing the name won't improve academics for students attending MISD schools. They are right. What they don't mention is keeping Lee also will not help the academic performance of the student going through the district. The metrics show that the brand hasn't elevated academic performance. I feel for board members because no matter the outcome of tonight's meeting, not everybody will be happy. I also remind those same board members, your job isn't to make everyone happy. It is to do what is right in representing your constituents, which brings me to an interesting part of the discussion. For weeks, we have read that the Lee renaming issue will lead to a new board. You sure about that? James Fuller in District 1 might lose his seat in November, but it won't be because of a vote to rename Lee. The same goes up for Robert Marquez in District 2. Tommy Bishop in District 3 isn't up this election cycle, but it is hard for me to believe that the voters in his district believe that the Lee renaming issue ranks as a number one priority. John Kennedy in District 4 decided not to seek re-election long before the Lee renaming became an issue. Only one of his three possible replacements considered the Lee issue worth talking about when they launched their bids. John Trichetti III and Rick Davis aren't on the ballot until 2022, and Brian Murray in District 7 voted against the renaming this summer. But he's not against the discussion. There might be turnover on the board over the next 4 years, but it will not be because of the name of a high school. Could the renaming vote have an impact on a future bond issue? Of course. But bond issues ultimately win or lose because of the plan. If constituents and influencers are successful in knocking off a bond because of a vote on renaming a school, one way or another, then this commodity has bigger issues than any of us could ever have imagined. However, the board decides, I am resigned to live with the decision, even if it is Tall City High School, which I am on the record as disliking very much. The truth is, the most consequential school board vote coming up, probably by the next school board, involves the selection of the next superintendent. Without a doubt, that selection will mean more to what is going on in the classrooms with our teachers and students. That is the vote I want board members thinking about, educating themselves on, and ultimately getting right. Today's meeting will be a circus, and a lot of piercing words will be said to the board on this matter in front of our community. Let's be clear. Neither side can claim to have represented the board in our community during this discussion. And tonight there will be those who take the opportunity to ridicule the board or other Midlanders as they make their point for a particular school name. Undecided board members will use the comments to help them make a decision, and a decision will be made. No matter if the name is Midland Lee High School, Tall City High School, Legacy of Equality and Excellence High School, or Legacy High School, residents will have to decide whether to support that school and its students and teachers and engage in discussions that involve improving academics in Midland. I dislike that this issue will garner as much attention as any in recent memory, but to those engaged with what is taking place with the district, welcome. I hope tonight's meeting isn't the last time you are engaged with decisions made by district leaders. Our community and students and teachers inside Midland ISD deserve better than that. This column is entitled, Senate Control is Bigger Than Ever. Republicans still generally favor the status quo. Democrats increasingly favor structural Senate change. By Charles Lane, Washington Post. The Senate is in play this election year, and not just because partisan control is up for grabs, though it is. Analysts by both Real Clear Politics and 538 make the Democrats favorites to recapture the majority, currently held by the Republicans, 53-47. In a more profound sense, voters are being asked to confront and consider the upper chamber's institutional role under the Constitution, which is rapidly evolving into a partisan issue. Until now, there was broad acceptance of the Senate's counter-majoritarian function and of the multiple ways that its two members per state design, coupled with six-year terms, encourage continuity, deliberation, and compromise. The contrast with the House of Representatives, which turns over biennially and allots power according to population, was taken for granted. Republicans still generally favor the status quo. It won't change if they keep the majority. Democrats, however, are furious at how Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, has exploited Senate procedures to promote his agenda and thwart theirs. Eager to enact an ambitious policy agenda and confident of winning the House and the presidency, they increasingly favor structural Senate change. As recently as 2017, when Republicans controlled the Senate, House, and White House, 33 Democratic senators joined 28 Republicans to sign an open letter endorsing the 60-vote filibuster as one of the, quote, existing rules, practices, and traditions, unquote, necessary to the Senate's unique role. Yet, former President Barack Obama this year branded the filibuster a Jim Crow relic, and Democratic vice presidential nominee Senator Kamala Harris, Democratic California, who signed the 2017 letter, said during her presidential campaign that she might change that position to help pass a Green New Deal. Like the 19th century politicians who added to the Union, with the Senate's partisan balance in mind, Democrats
arithmetically accurately, decry the body's bias against population centers they represent, and speak of admitting the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico as likely blue states, once the filibuster no longer stands in the way. Undoubtedly, the GOP-controlled Senate looms as an obstacle to major legislation, including most recently a fiscal stimulus package for the virus-ravaged economy. Can the chamber be rendered less dysfunctional and more responsible under Democratic control, while preserving those unique features that help make it more than just the instrument of temporary majorities? That would depend on there being a sufficient number of senators who still believe that politics is a repeat player game in which today's majority is tomorrow's minority, not a zero-sum proposition. Small states and their senators will play a crucial part. Of the 50 states, 22 possess 6 or fewer electoral votes. This group encompasses 14 red states and also 8 blue ones, with 15 Democratic senators among them. Yes, the filibuster is tainted by past association with anti-civil rights Southern machinations. But in the present day, it helps level the legislative playing field among states of different sizes, amplifying the leverage of smaller ones. Otherwise, would there be a huge naval shipyard in Maine or Coast Guard facilities in landlocked West Virginia? Good policy or not, such largesse helps explain why Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia, 5 electoral votes, and Angus King, a Maine, 4 votes electoral independent who caucuses with the Democrats, are cool to filibuster elimination. King has actually revised what was an earlier anti-filibuster position and now says he's 100% against ending it. Still, small state Democratic senators would undoubtedly come under ferocious pressure in the event that Democrats retake the Senate and the Biden administration's legislative agenda founders on a McConnell-led filibuster. At that point, one exit strategy might be a deal between small state Democrats on the one hand and the GOP leader on the other, whereby McConnell would allow votes on Democratic legislation in return for preserving the filibuster, at least in modified form, and not admitting new states. To imagine such a deal is to admit how far-fetched it is. The Republican base would react with fury. Democrats who did business with McConnell, rather than give him a taste of their own medicine, could be inviting primary challenges. Yet McConnell has always asserted that his paramount interest is the institution and its prerogatives. Would he make a tactical retreat accordingly, especially since he is 78 years old and can't have too many re-election campaigns ahead of him? And what would be the position of a President Joe Biden, a longtime man from the Senate, from tiny Delaware? All but surely a one-termer who has a history of negotiating with McConnell and has pointedly not called for an end to the filibuster. All of the above is speculation, to be sure. But the clear lesson of American history, especially pre-Civil War history, is that national political division, sooner or later, mutates into conflict over the Senate, followed by conflict within it. The deeper the division, the more dangerous the conflict.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, October 14, 2020. Trinity Hall of Honor. Midlander Kevin Blomqvist speaks at the 5th Annual Trinity Alumni Hall of Honor on Thursday. Blomqvist, Managing Director of Blomqvist Investment Group, was one of 3 inductees. Also honored were Odessan Craig Stoker, Communications Director for West Texas Food Bank, and Austin resident Mary Philby Dollins, Outreach Director for Women's Services for the St. David's Healthcare Partnership. Flu shot clinic set for those 60 and older. A flu vaccination clinic for residents 60 and older will be held this month at the Midland Health Department, Kingsway Mall, 3303 West Illinois Avenue. The clinic is 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays. The health department also provides clinical services by appointment only, 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m., Monday through Friday. For more information or to make an appointment, call 681-7613. Revival is planned. Kingdom Encounter Weekend, described as a revival of repentance and restoration, is planned for 6 p.m. Friday through Sunday at 6612 Farm to Market Road 307. The event is being presented by Kingdom Encounter Ministries, according to an email from one of the organizers. For more information, text Revival 432-2-94090. Salvation Army to sign up angels. Salvation Army of Midland soon will be signing up children 12 and younger for the annual Angel Tree. Parents or legal guardians would need to provide valid ID, children's birth certificates, and proof of income. Sign-ups will be 9 a.m. to noon and 1 to 4 p.m. through Friday at 600 East Wall Street. For more information, call 683-3614. KMB, looking for cleanup groups. Groups are needed to clean up two areas, Big Spring Street and Fiesta Avenue, and West Scarborough Drive and North Main Street, according to a press release from Keep Midland Beautiful. To register for a cleanup, go to keepmidlandbeautiful.org or call 688-7745. MMH has Sharps Disposal Kiosk. Midland Memorial Hospital has installed a kiosk for safe disposal of sharps, such as needles, syringes, lancets, or finger stick devices, auto-injectors including epinephrine or insulin pens, infusion sets, and connection needles sets, according to a press release. The red receptacle is located inside the emergency department entrance, 400 Rosalind Redfern Grover Parkway. Sharps may be disposed of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Luke's Pumpkin Patch is open. Pumpkin Patch is now open at St. Luke's United Methodist Church, 3100 West Louisiana Avenue. Hours are 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and noon to 5 p.m. Sunday through October 31, or when organizers run out of pumpkins, according to a press release. Pumpkins are priced by size and begin at $1. There will be books to read in the patch and coloring sheets. Social distancing must be maintained and health recommendations followed. GSDSW hosting virtual recruitment. Girl Scouts of the Desert Southwest will be hosting online robot building recruitment parties. Girls in grades 4 through 12 can join the online party any Thursday through November 19. Girls in kindergarten through 3rd grade can join the online party any Tuesday through November 24. The parties begin at 7 p.m. Central Time. To attend the parties, go to www.gsdsw.org. Click on Robot Building Party and RSVP today. Girls will receive a Zoom link to join in the party, according to a press release. Girls can join virtual troop meetings for free and join a troop in person at a later date, according to the release. For more information, visit the website. Today in Midland history. In 1987, a 58.5-hour drama began in Midland as 18-month-old Jessica McClure slid 22 feet down an abandoned water well at a private daycare center.
This is the obituary column, Wednesday, October 14th, 2020. Lloyd Horrell. Lloyd Horrell, 64, of Midland, Texas, passed away on October 10th, 2020, at his home in Midland, Texas. Lloyd was born on September 3rd, 1956, to Lloyd and Bessie Franks Guthrie Horrell in Midland, Texas. He married Dorothy McKeon on July 15th, 1978, in Midland, Texas. He is survived by his spouse, Dorothy Horrell, two sons, Philip Horrell, Maria, and Daniel Horrell, Victoria Gonzalez, three grandsons, Zach Horrell, Joshua Horrell, and Caleb Horrell, and two siblings, Marvin Guthrie and family, and Opal Patterson and family. He is preceded in death by his parents, Lloyd Way Horrell and Bessie Franks Guthrie. Funeral service will be on Wednesday, October 14th at 2 p.m. in the Greenwood Baptist Church Cemetery, with Billy Rays officiating. Burial will take place at Greenwood Baptist Church Cemetery. Patricia Wrinkle. Patricia Wrinkle, 81, went on to be with her Lord and Savior on October 11th, 2020 in Rankin, Texas, following diagnosis of a pleural effusion. Patricia was born July 20th, 1939 in Bronte, Texas, the daughter of Vernon Hiram Brock and Nidra Bell Brock. She married Bill Wrinkle on May 18th, 1958 in Midland, and to this union one child was born, Carrie Brent Wrinkle. Patricia is survived by her son Carrie Brent and her grandchildren Kylie and Caleb and his wife Emma Wrinkle of Rankin. Also surviving is one sister, Ellen Karen Ellen Carol Martin and her husband Bob Martin of Grand Prairie, Texas, and one brother, Victor Hiram Brock, and his wife Karen of Grand Prairie, Texas, and sister-in-law Judith Brock of Eunice, New Mexico, and several nieces, nephews, and cousins. Patricia was preceded in death by her husband, Bill Wrinkle, parents Hiram and Nedra Brock, brothers Bobby Glenn Brock and Jerry Keith Brock, and her sister Mary Frances Wysong. Funeral services for Patricia Brock Wrinkle will be held at First Baptist Church, Rankin, Texas, on Thursday, October 15th at 4 p.m., with Reverend Jim Medley and Reverend J.C. Tankersley officiating. Burial will follow in the Rankin Cemetery. Our expression of appreciation go out to those who prayed for Patricia and her family. Memorials may be directed to the charity of one's choice. Bill and Patricia now will rest together again with the remembrance. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures. 1 Corinthians 13:7. Death notices. Anastasio A. Perez. Anastasio A. Perez, 85, of Midland, Texas, passed away Friday, October 9th, 2020. Viewing will be Tuesday, October 13th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Wednesday, October 14th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a rosary to be recited at 7 p.m. Wednesday evening at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. A funeral service is set for Thursday, October 15th, at 2 p.m., at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow to Serenity Memorial Gardens. He is survived by his wife, Margarita Leon, three daughters, Flora Leon Romero, Margarita Perez Cepeda, and Leticia Perez, five sisters, one brother, and 14 grandchildren. Peggy Lou Holscher. Peggy Lou Holscher, 83, of Midland, passed away on October 12, 2020. Viewing will be on Thursday, October 15th, from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. Graveside service will be on Friday, October 16th, at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading the Odessa American front page articles for Wednesday, October 14th, 2020. City-county tax fight rekindles. City files claim with state for part of county's new sales tax money. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths Tuesday exoriated the city of Odessa's recent application to the Texas Attorney General's office to claim part of the revenues from the county sales tax, which is dedicated to bolstering law enforcement, road maintenance and construction, and illegal dumping enforcement. It's very disheartening to know that the city is trying to take the funds from the county, Griffiths said in an afternoon phone interview. It's not only disheartening, it makes me very angry. This would directly impact law enforcement services in the county and directly impact my employees and our efforts to be competitive in our pay in the jail and law enforcement. It would potentially affect the way we do business, so I think they need to back the hell off. The sheriff was asked if he was surprised by the news of the city's appeal to Attorney General Ken Paxton of Austin for ruling on the legitimacy of the county's 1.25 cent tax that was approved by voters in November 2018 and the city's right to take part of the proceeds. "Yes, it did take me by surprise," Griffiths said. Deferring to a city-county confab on December 10, 2019, around a big table in the commissioner's courtroom about inter-local contracts and the tax revenues, he said, "The last I heard, all this had quieted down and we had a general agreement between the city and county. But obviously, they don't want to do that. I don't know where this is coming from, the city council, the city attorney's office, or the city manager. The city council candidates need to stand up and speak their minds in the next 2 weeks because there may be some new endorsements." Odessa and Ector County are one community, Griffiths said. The people from West Odessa, Pleasant Farms, Gardendale, and Goldsmith all go into the city to go out to eat, buy new tires, and get their oil changed. The city needs to realize that and stop trying to take our funds because that would directly affect the services we provide to the county residents. Late Tuesday afternoon, the city of Odessa issued a statement on the matter. "The city of Odessa became aware of a matter which would significantly impact future planning and growth for the city. On December 10, 2019, the city had a discussion with Ector County at an open public meeting. However, the entities were unable to reach an agreement. In order to resolve this issue, an attorney general opinion is being sought to provide a determination on several issues. It is not the city's hope or desire to steal or take money from the county. It is the city's hope that the attorney general's opinion will yield a plan that will allow all entities to prosper equally, the statement said. Expecting reduced revenues in the fiscal year that began October 1st, the commissioners have budgeted for $12 million in sales tax revenues this year after collecting $14.7 million during 2019-20. In late 2019's meeting, City Attorney Natasha Brooks and County Attorney Dusty Gallivan clashed not long after the discussion on the sales tax, which began with Gallivan disputing Brooks's emphasis on the date listed in the notice that the county had sent to the Texas Comptroller's Office in Austin about its eligibility to start collecting the tax. Gallivan had said before the meeting that he would eagerly fight the city in court if necessary. Then, Hayes and City Councilwoman Peggy Dean, sitting across from each other, argued about the collections. "We don't want to take any of the county's money," said Dean, explaining that the city merely wanted to levy taxes for services if it made a voluntary annexation inside the county's new assistance district. Hayes countered that the city and county were arguing over the same taxpayers' money and that the city's enhanced collections would amount to a double dip from the taxpayers' pockets. Brooks said that, as a conciliatory gesture, the city would reduce its extraterritorial jurisdiction from 5 miles to the 3.5-mile ETJ it claimed before declaring itself to be over 100,000 in population in 2018. Others who took part in the 2.5-hour meeting were Councilman Dewey Bryant, who is now running for mayor, Commissioners Eddie Shelton, Greg Simmons, Dale Childers, and Armando Rodriguez. City Council members were Detra White, Malcolm Hamilton, and Mari Willis, and City Manager Michael Marrero. First in Line: Early Voting Attracts Crowds, by Michael Bauer. Early voting is underway in Ector County as hundreds of voters made their way to their locations to submit ballots for the 2020 elections. Tuesday was the first day of early voting, which runs through October 30th. Odessans also tried to get a head start and beat the rush to have one less thing to worry about by the time Election Day arrives on November 3rd. Voters in Odessa will not only be participating in the presidential election, but also in the city contest, which includes choosing a new mayor. The early voting schedule will last through October 30th. Odessans can vote early at one of 5 locations, including the Ector County Courthouse Annex, Kellis Turner Community Building, West Lake Hardware Store, the Globe Theater at Odessa College, and the Salinas Community Building. People can vote from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. today, Thursday, and Friday, as well as October 19th through the 23rd. On October 24th, the voting hours for the Ector County Annex, Room 104, will be 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the other early voting locations. The voting hours for October 25th are 1 to 6 p.m. at all the locations. For Ector County Elections Administrator Lisa Sertuch, the turnout for the first day of early voting was a little surprising. As of 2 p.m. Tuesday, Sertuch said a total of 1,878 turned out to vote. "The turnout has been phenomenal," Sertuch said. "We had a line at 7 a.m. already wrapped around the annex, and Westlake had a line, and so did Odessa College. I knew that we would have a line, but not wrapped around the annex building." Sertuche said the reasons for the decent turnout were the presidential election and the city elections. She said that there were no major problems with the voting machines in the early hours on Tuesday. "Everything's been running smooth," Sertuche said. She also added that they've been taking COVID safety measures. "So far, the voters have been wearing masks, and we've had a lot of marking outside with red tape for self-distancing," Sertuche said. "We have our workers cleaning the machines before the voter goes up to vote, so we're taking precautions." Roger Ehrenberg, who's lived in Odessa for 20 years, said he usually doesn't miss an opportunity to submit his ballot early, With early voting, you can just come by today or tomorrow and maybe the lines won't be as long, he said. Donna Kelm, who was also out voting early on Tuesday, said getting it out of the way was also a relief. I want to get it done, Kelm said. I want to get it done early, and I want to get it counted. It's a peace of mind. You don't have to battle with everyone to do it at the last minute. You know what you've done, and you are ahead of the game. For more information, call 432-489-4030 or visit the Ector County Elections Administration website at www.co.ector.tx.us/page/ector.elections. Honor the Blue recognizes local law enforcement by Royal McGregor. A couple of months ago, Lance Van Zandt and Chase McCain started to mull over ideas on how to honor local law enforcement agencies. Van Zandt and McCain had originally settled on inviting the public to gather in front of the Odessa Police Department. However, that morphed into a grander plan, which includes food prepared by the Odessa Chuckwagon Gang and donations set to be divided between OPD, Midland Police Department, Ector County Sheriff's Office, and Midland County Sheriff's Office. I don't feel like most people in West Texas feel negatively about the police, Van Zandt explained. We wanted to do something to show them that we appreciate them. Honor the Blue in Odessa is scheduled for 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday at the Ector County Coliseum, Barn A, while Honor the Blue in Midland is set for 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. October 24th at the Momentum Bank Ballpark parking lot. Van Zandt said the public is invited to bring signs and wear shirts that support members of law enforcement. The public may donate toward Honor the Blue through purchasing meals from the Odessa Chuckwagon Gang for $15 a plate and donations. According to its website, Honor the Blue hopes to raise $25,000 for each city that can be used toward the purchase of a new vehicle and training equipment for ECSO and MCSO, rifle vests for OPD, and officer training for MPD. It's heartwarming to know that you live in a community where the citizens support and appreciate law enforcement, Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said. Van Zandt said he doesn't have an expected turnout, but is looking forward to a good showing. I'm hopeful that there will be thousands of people, Van Zandt said. I really don't know.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.